Welcome to The Marketing Commute, a podcast that explores the roads taken and the lessons learned by truly world-class Australian marketers. I'm Mike Boyd, and joining me on the commute this time are Andrew Baxter, Board Director, Senior Advisor and Marketing Columnist at The Australian, as well as Carmen Becker, Partner at KPMG Australia and Leader of their CMO Advisory Practice. In this episode of Season 3 of The Marketing Commute, we're very lucky to be joined in the studio by Jackie Lee Joe, previous CMO of Netflix and BBC Studios. Welcome, Jackie. Jackie's had a diverse and very global career in marketing, starting here in Sydney, then continuing to Europe, the UK, the US, and we'll find out all about this when we chat to Jackie a little later on in the show. All right, team. What's caught our eye this week?
Well, I think for me, just in line with Jackie being on the show, was that BritBox launched in Australia this week. It's a partnership between BBC and ITV, obviously pitched at the Anglophiles here who like their British series. So, yeah, well, we might have a little chat about that later on.
The summer regular of the skin cancer campaigns coming out, and this one in particular is called Game On Mole, and it's really edgy, quite fun, put out by the Melanoma Institute of Australia, and they've done t-shirts that you can buy. It's fantastic. Really nice to see.
It's always good to get that, you know, with everything else that's gone on this year, you sort of forget we're coming into summer and like all these
things.
Yeah,
there's
that
a lot to think about.
A lot to suddenly go, oh, that's right, summer it gets hot and people have to be, you know, careful of their skin, so it's a good thing to do. Look, the other thing, the only thing that's caught my eye because it just popped up in the last sort of, you know, hour or two has been, obviously there's a fair amount of trade tensions happening with our friends north of the equator. So China's just whacked a 200% tariff on Australian wine being imported into China. So that'll be something to certainly, you know, keep an eye on and check back in with our fellow wine producers.
Yeah, it'd be tough for a lot of them. And, accusations around dumping cheap wine, I think the federal government's gone back and asked for some proof and reasons why. But, I think hopefully for our winemakers, like many of our primary producers, we can get through this and they can continue to have some successful times. So in this episode of The Marketing Commute, we welcome Jackie Lee Joe, until recently the CMO of Netflix, located in LA. Jackie graduated right here at the University of Sydney.
Right here, probably slightly down the road.
The building
would have
looked a little bit different. Yes. The Bachelor of Economics, went on to complete her Masters of Commerce in Marketing at the Uni of New South Wales. Jackie kickstarted her career with Ansett on the airline front, moved to Europe with Orange as their global head of brand experience. Since then, worked with Virgin Mobile as the GM of brand and acquisition. Worked for Skype as the global director of audience marketing. Be interesting to talk about Skype later, given what's happened with Zoom and Teams and everything else during COVID. And then was the CMO of BBC Studios in London. And as mentioned, Jackie, until very recently, was the CMO of Netflix based in LA before popping back to Sydney with her family. We're very excited to chat more to Jackie about her journey. So Jackie, welcome to the Marketing Commute.
Thank you, guys. Good to see you all.
Now, the question we sort of ask everyone straight up is, there's normally a moment that really kickstarts your marketing career or at least makes you realise that you are in the right place, that marketing's the thing for you. Can you remember what that moment was?
Yeah, I started after Sydney Uni. I started in accountancy and auditing, and that realisation of this is probably not for me was about 3 weeks in. I kind of knew it when I thought, oh my goodness, I'm really going to need my Sony Walkman to kind of get me through the auditing of invoices and so forth. And I thought, oh, I need to look around. And so my former boyfriend, who was still at Sydney, who was doing a PhD, he picked out in the corridors the Ansett Australia Graduate Program. And he said, maybe you should apply for that. So I applied for that. There were 8 grads. I was the only one from New South Wales, so I moved down to Melbourne to kind of take it. And if you remember, way, way back, Billy, you remember Ansett circa 1994, 95, it was all about the Golden Wing Lounge and the start of the international product and those Enya ads and the Enya music.
Oh, yes.
Storms of Africa.
Yeah.
All of that.
Oh, cue
the
music.
I know. It was a wonderful brand and so attractive. And I thought, I've got to get me some of that. So I went down to Melbourne, had a great time. I did an 18-month rotation there. And in the midst of that, so I did strat planning and analysis, which is great. It was all really applying my economics learning. So it was like fleet methodology, you know, route profitability analysis, all of that. Then I had time in our retail division, Travelland, Ansett Holidays, the wholesalers. And then I had time, of course, in national marketing. And it was a pretty easy bait and switch because you had literally working on the Capital Shuttle, new product development in terms of both airside and ground side kind of components of product. And then on the other side, I had to kind of review all of the in-flight entertainment on every plane in the fleet. And that really that took fun. A lot of weeks.
Like short really hard
travel. Yeah. And then on top of that, I remember having to review. So if you remember, Friends came out in 94.
Right.
So I was doing this in 95. And we were told, we're thinking about this for the in-flight service. Why don't you watch, you know, these apps of Friends and see if it's going to be good for us. And I'm like, I found my call.
My 13-year-old daughter has just done all that and watched every exactly. episode of Friends.
It all ties back to Netflix. So, yeah, it was brilliant. I loved it. And I kind of knew at that moment that it was marketing. It had elements of strategy. It had elements of creativity. It had big picture thinking, you know, those sorts of components really kind of get me going. Yeah.
And that was a time when you discovered marketing. When did your career really accelerate? Was there a specific moment or point in time or company?
Yeah, I think there are kind of, well, I think there are little moments that you kind of inflection points that you think of. Like definitely our move overseas kind of expanded, if you like, the myriad of opportunities.
And this was the move to London first?
So it was actually supposed to be New York. Yeah. And what happened was we got to that moment. And I think all Australians that have gone overseas probably have this inherent acute kind of case of FOMO. And for me, it was definitely about FOMO, maybe because I'm a Saggy. I don't know. but there was this moment where we had finished our postgrad degrees and we'd been working full time. We're like, this cannot be it. Like we've like literally reduced our social life to a minimum and we want to go back out and really kind of party large. It was really the drive, wasn't Korea. It was we wanted to kind of go and live a little bit, travel, see the world, do culture. And in looking at that, my boyfriend, now husband, wanted to go to Tokyo. I wanted to go to London. He didn't want to go to London. I didn't want to go to Tokyo. So we listed down our top three cities. Number two was New York. And we were like, okay, this is New York. So this is like 98 going into 99. And he's like, oh, well, okay, let's pull a path to New York. And I'm like, okay. But I was working on the Olympics with ANSET. And so I thought in my head, oh, this is going to take time. We're going to plan this. We're going to get there. It's probably going to allow me to see my way through the Olympics. But of course, he got a job 2 weeks later.
Determined, right. Very determined.
Freaking attorney, yes. And he nicked off, and so I had 12 months really of kind of planning it as I was doing the Olympics. I was doing, and at that time, you know, the E3 visa wasn't a thing, so there were very few Australians. So you literally, like, I had few mates, you know, that you know had loose networks into New York. And I had to kind of go in and do breakfast, lunch and dinner and kind of meet people. The scene in New York was, it was quite a cozy scene of people that had black books at the time. So there was no real, you know, internet searches weren't an enormous thing at that moment.
Yeah, right.
Monster
course,
was just
course.
A new thing. So, yes. And you didn't have like Kendall Tarrant and other kind of agencies. It was just a harder market to kind of crack. Mm. And so it took me 12 months to kind of sort that through. I get to the end of Olympics and it was that moment of dot-com-ness, right?
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
Where you didn't want to go to the Ogilvy's and the traditional agencies. You wanted to go for the new fandangled things. And one of them was March 1st, which was a combination of the Mitchell Madison Group, the kind of US Web CKS Interactive, and a brand. Agency all coming together. They all came together too late, clearly, because the NASDAQ was already, you know, about to, you know, it was all happening at that moment. But that was the interesting intersection for me because it was brand strategy, business strategy, and product and kind of interactive kind of new areas. And the move from like communications, e-communications into e-commerce, all of those transitions were going on. Yeah. And so I took a job with them and I got there and, of course, the party turned into a bust and it really did bust and it busted. It literally, I walked into New York and it imploded. And so then I kind of flipped the party over to London. So I got my way after all.
Right.
Yeah, I got there after all. And I joined the mobile internet boom and the mobile internet party. So I've kind of been able to very luckily kind of flip across. So London it was in the end.
So for you, what was really around, I mean, apart from sort of trying to, you know, navigate, you wanted to go one way, your boyfriend wanted to go the other. Was there anything then from a career point of view you sort of learned at ANZ that you kind of think, I want to go and take this kind of at a global scale?
Yeah.
Obviously, you've had a full start in New York and then you sort of arrived in London.
Yeah.
You know,
it was.
You kind of go, right now I know what I want to.
Yeah. And it was that thread of transformation.
Yeah.
So I had done a role at Travelland as alongside, crazily, what I was doing with the Olympic stuff, which was around building the first booking engines. So I was the only one with the modem and the Netscape, and it was just me. And we were starting to look at very clunky integrations with systems into Galileo booking. And so you had none of the discounts that any of the travel agents would have had, but you had the basic fare booking classes in play and you could actually transact. And so off the back of that was why I kind of pulled into doing internet consulting and kind of really thinking of that area, that pivot into e-commerce. And then when I got into Orange, the job was actually to look at this transition, right? A transition from analog to digital, the transition from voice to voice and data. And, you know, Orange was at that moment where they had invested in Spectrum and they needed to start to think about what did that mean? And what did that mean in the world of gaming, publishing, music? What did that mean in the world of email and communication extensions and calendaring? And so we were working on the strategy for mobility. And it was all going on in Europe. That's where mobility was birthed, right? And so that was all about people, time, places, and payment. That is the essence of mobility. And so we were translating that into product. We were translating that into launching the first ever smartphone, which was actually with Microsoft in 2002, called the SPV, Sound Pictures Video. And then, of course, fast forward to, you know, Carphone, the last thing I did before I went on mat leave there was to help the launch of iPhone 1. So you can see all these kind of moments, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I flip out of telco and into Skype, which is over-the-top communications.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I was doing was running integrated marketing, so all the acquisition, retention, integrated campaign activity. But I was also running two other divisions. One was the broadcast media division, and one of them was the entertainment partnerships division out of New York and out of LA. And that pivot is really the start of understanding that Skype is a broadcast tool, and that's the convergence of communications, content, and technology. And so then that flips you into BBC, and then that flips you back out. Like, that's an incumbent, traditional player being disrupted. And so, you know, when you're looking at that, originally they had recruited me because they thought they were going to go global iPlayer, so looking for over-the-top marketing experience. You come back in, they've changed their minds, and so you kind of go, okay, well, you've got to, in the world of digital, you've got to own either supply or distribution, ideally both, in which case we've got to double down on supply. So it's about IP building and really pivoting, again, what was a very linear set of IP properties, right? So you think linear channels for BBC Earth, or you think, you know, basically physical ancillaries, like selling the DVDs or selling the kind of games or the publishing, and you kind of go, well, we've got to flip this entirely into extending into the world of digital. So extensions onto Snap, what did that mean for layering our content onto Google Earth? How do you think about optimizing for that content and co-producing with Tencent, where you're looking at short form videos, long form, you're optimizing it for an AVOD and an SVOD set of models, and you're doing kind of communities through WeChat. So, you know, a lot of that is kind of part of the DNA of kind of stuff that I'd done earlier that you build on and build on. And then Netflix is the coming back together for me of that wonderful combination of product and content and the unique, you know, proposition and advantage it has as a result.
And you were talking about doing that, being in part of the future of mobility back in Europe when that term was first coined.
Yeah.
People are talking about now we're in the age of a new type of mobility, you know, with autonomous vehicles.
That's right.
With
pervasive 5G, computing. Yep.
Exactly. So what do you think, what are you seeing in that space and your experience, particularly from being at Netflix and I guess having this view that we don't see as much here from an American Hollywood point of view?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many ways to access content. We're in a post-scarcity world of content, and content is everywhere, and it's accessible from everywhere. And I think, you know, the key really is to understand those platforms and really think about what is platform-adaptive content experiences and how do you really bring that to life, and the differences between what you might use this screen for and the intimacy or the interactivity of the content that you can actually, you know, content experiences you can actually provide, and how does that work alongside the 16:9 screen? I think there's a lot more that we can do to think about evolving those experiences on for users.
I mean, along that journey, you've obviously had quite a few mentors along the way. Is there any that stand out, any that have helped you a lot on that journey?
You know, I got a kind of a couple of sets of people that I really kind of go to, I guess. And I've been really lucky to have had people as you go around the world, you know, that are there to buoy you up, right? Or people that are there to just, you know, you can't appreciate enough people that are just willing to listen and provide, you know, great soundboarding for you. And then you've got people that are just really kind of brilliant at telling you as it is, right? And kind of, you know, giving you both constructive advice and you know, pretty downright great objective advice about things and evaluating outcomes. And so, you know, I've had some great people. One, a former kind of HR colleague of mine that I always use for thinking about career decisions. And in fact, an exec recruiter that I've worked with for years, who's just, doesn't matter what the job is, she's just always there for you. And, you know, when you're looking at making and evaluating choices, you know, as we've had to do over the last 20 years of kind of being in and out of the world, is that you can't separate off your professional career, you know, decisions from, of course, the life ones. And so they've been brilliant at kind of keeping that more rounded and balanced view, and I really appreciate that in them. And then I've got people that you just pick up over the years, right? Who always will bring a fresh perspective and, you know, and a different way of thinking about it. And, you know, as I've navigated my way through this year, they've been invaluable in kind of, you know, resetting or kind of framing things in a different way and helping you kind of see, you know, the value in new life perspective or different opportunities. And then I've had leaders who, and, you know, I think this is a real privilege, leaders that have had true integrity and character, and you can see their principle, and you can see their principle across everything they do and into action. And you learn so much from them. And they have, you know, one in particular has just been so brilliant at kind of giving me honest appraisal and, you know, good feedback. And, you know, I really value that in him.
And what about you passing on that mentorship to then people that you've worked under you, or that, you know, and that may well be your view in the future? You know, how does, you know, what do you think would be those sorts of first key lessons that if you sort of came across some great, you know, talent, whether it was working for you or someone you've met, and you sort of go, this is a real person that I would like to now help nurture. What are the things that, you know, two or three things you kind of go, oh, those gems that I've picked up, this is what I really want to help?
Sometimes it depends, because people come for mentorship for many, many things. But, you know, quite often people come to me with what they think is the linear path to getting where they want to get to, which is, you know, how do I get from A to B? Can you tell me how it's done? And I guess my key philosophy there is that you should just always be open. And if you're always open, then you tend to sometimes attract opportunity and kind of, but also see opportunity in everything that that comes through, right? And it is this world. COVID has, you know, Sierra's proved it out more than anything, right? That constant change, right? This notion that you have a long-term plan and you want to be a CMO in 10 years, who cares? It's not even, you know, it's actually the journey. And the fact that actually you can't lay down track now, you have to kind of create your own path, and that's at every stage. And that those opportunities when you apply that philosophy, can lead to, and certainly in my case I've benefited from, working across a wide range of industries and working across a wide range of marketing functions. You know, I've done product marketing, I've done franchise brand management, I've done growth marketing, I've done, you know, product and content marketing. Those two things, you know, very slightly different skill sets, right? I mean, one much more creatively and of the content. You know, that kind of mix and breadth of things, partnerships, stands you in really good stead. It means that you can make different connections. It means that if you come from a different industry, sometimes you can see what has gone before, right? If you've been in other industries that have been disrupted, you come into media and you kind of go, I've kind of seen some of these things before. Yeah. And so that enables you to bring a new perspective into whatever you do.
So just going to your time at Netflix, because obviously Netflix is this one of those companies that...
I've got questions from my teenagers, so you'll get me.
I don't think I've seen many presentations recently where someone doesn't say, you know, just like Netflix, we want to be this and that. And so what's some of the keys to the success and the rise of Netflix, in your view, from the inside?
Yeah, I think it's got some amazing strengths. I think it... as we briefly mentioned earlier, it knew to be hyper-local and it knew to kind of nuance into making a connection in Britain, and that is not the same as how you might make a connection on different titles in America, right? Like, knowing that you need to build authentic connection has been a big part of its success. That pipeline is ridiculous, and the ability to kind of combine that pipeline with very self-aware memeable and other conversational moments that have virality at the heart of it has been also part of its success, and it can drive conversation. And when we walked into COVID and Tiger King happened, you kind of go, wow, the intensity of global conversations is kind of breathtaking, right? Yeah. And as people were starting to mine the depths of the catalogue, things that might have we thought were only a title that would only be in this part of the world have ricocheted across the other part of the world, right? And so the other part of Netflix's success is understanding that you need to be truly of the world. To be a 21st century media brand today, you have to be of the world. And so that means commissioning a breadth of international and original content from every market of the world, licensed and originals, that truly enable you to inhabit that world. And off the back of that, this notion that stories can come from anywhere to be loved everywhere is a really important aspect of that. So yeah, Netflix can be the place, right, to celebrate and illuminate and champion great storytelling to any corner of the world for audiences, right? Mm. And in doing so, it can connect you to those stories, but it can also connect you to each other. So that's the, you know, it was the ethos of all the brand work that we did. We rolled that campaign out in September.
Why do you think, and because you were inside the tent also at BBC, but why do you think players like Foxtel here, for example, who I thought, if you look back in hindsight, were probably best placed to do that version here, and they've probably had a couple of false starts before they've gotten to somewhere. But the BBC as well, right? They've had such great content. Like, why do you think they weren't able to see this, get there quicker?
Netflix is a newer entity, you know. Yeah. A lot of the, you know, if you think about Disney, Warner's, BBC, they've been around for 100 years. You know, BBC turns 100 in a couple of years' time. And so, you know, it takes a little bit longer in that world where you have only really thought about how you were going to build out your cultural canon in one way and kind of export it out to the world. It takes a little bit of a mind shift to say, actually, we want to be of the world and think about what it means, therefore, to have stories that are relevant for audiences all around the world. I think also, you know, Netflix has had a almost ruthless focus, right? And that focus has stood it in really good stead. It hasn't had to worry about incumbent infrastructure and, you know, old systems of linear programming, linear channel management. It didn't have to worry about any of that. It kind of really cut well beyond it. For any other media company, that's a much more conflicted place to be, right? And you are, you know, sitting in companies like the BBC where you have to fund that yourself. You're not going out to capital markets and, you know, raising investment. That's a massive advantage for digital entities like Netflix. And, you know, everybody else has been caught in the vice. It's made it much trickier to know when to cut the cord on things and to kind of make the pivots in the business. So it's less cut and dry, I think, than people like to make out it is, right? It's more complicated.
And I think the other thing, I was having this conversation with my children the other day around Netflix, and because they just can't fathom that, you know, anything that's cool today is, you know, wasn't invented 2 weeks ago. But, you know, Netflix had knew its customer from a long way back. You know, if you look at back to Andrew's question, you know, the BBC, Foxtel, they actually didn't know what they had customers, but they didn't know what their customers were doing. Whereas Netflix knew, you know, with the DVDs and whatever else was being sent out, they knew, well, you know, this is a new DVD on Formula One, we know Mike's going to buy this without a shirt. So they had that profiling on a customer. When they then shifted to it being digital distribution, they already knew so much about segmentation. Yeah. And
then they took it to a whole nother level.
Correct, which I think just... But following on from Andrew's question, how do other people just get it so wrong? Like, it just... It's amazing.
It's always one of those things, right? In hindsight, you kind of go, wow, should have made that decision, whatever. But I think when you're in the cut and thrust of being in a boardroom and you're looking at down the barrel of trying to maintain results, and you know that in many ways digital takes a lot of the margin and the value out of a model, right? That's hard kind of, you know, executive call to make. And it takes a lot to say, okay, therefore we're going to put it all of our eggs in this one basket.
Yeah. And I think change has been a constant theme of our conversations. What does the road ahead look like for you? What changes are
coming?
Yeah.
I finished up at Netflix, but I was working from here, and I had been doing 18-hour days. I've been starting at midnight. I've been running till 6 or 7 in the evening. Then I have dinner with the kids and I go to sleep for 3 hours and I start it again.
Oh, wow.
Because I had to get all that bloody campaign stuff out that I was pitching agencies. We're getting that campaign done. It was all done during COVID. And so when you're running, and you're running a team, a very big team globally, and this is, I'd forgotten, because I'd been in two jobs where, most recent jobs, where I'd been at the center of time zone gravity. I'd forgotten what it was like to be on the edge of time zone gravity.
Yes.
And that actually, I was like, oh, God. You know, so it really affected the schedules. And so I did not have one of those COVIDs where I was baking cookies for my kids or, like, really spending time with them. And so now I'm trying to decompress a little bit. I think it was one of those moments. I usually have them once a decade where you just get off the merry-go-round for half a second.
Thank you so much for sharing that journey with us. It's been an epic one for our hour, but I'm sure your journey has been just as epic. So thank you so much for joining us, Jackie, on the Marketing Commute. It's great.
Oh, good to be here. Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. All right, that's it for this episode of the Marketing Commute. Thanks to our guest, Jackie Lee Joe, to my co-hosts Andrew Baxter and Carmen Becker.
Thank you.
Got it hot. our producers Wing and Frankie, the studios here at the University of Sydney Business School, and to Visual Domain, our new partner for season 3. You can find the Marketing Commute on all good podcast networks, and you can read more detailed show notes and find links from each episode and find out more about our guests and our presenters at our website, themarketingcommute.com. That's it for now. We'll see you next time.